Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Isabel Allende, whose new novel is In the Midst of Winter, and novelist Mark Halperin, whose new book is Paris in the Present Tense. It is a great honor to speak with Isabel Allende, the Chilean-American novelist known for her 23 books, House of the Spirits and Eva Luna among them, which are published in 35 languages with 70 million copies of her books in print worldwide. Today we'll be speaking about her new novel, In the Midst of Winter, which is about so many things: aging, the challenges facing immigrants to the United States, the possibility of love at any time, and the great arc of the human story to be found in every life. Isabel last came to New Orleans for her wonderful novel, Island Beneath the Sea, so it will be a pleasure to welcome her back. Isabel Allende, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for inviting me to the program.
Oh, so happy. The title of this book comes from a quotation from Albert Camus. In the midst of winter, I finally found that there was within me an invincible summer. What an inspiration, and that's what happens in this book.
Well, I think that sentence summarizes the whole book. It is the story of three people who are living in a sort of emotional winter. We all go through those things in our lives, those periods in which we feel that nothing is working, that everything is just gray and boring, or sometimes painful. And those long winters sometimes seem eternal, but there is always an invincible summer waiting for us if we have an open heart and we let it happen. And so this is a story of three people in an emotional winter, because they have been traumatized in their lives, who find themselves together in an adventure of life and death that they were not looking for. And instead of bugging off because it was dangerous, they opt for solidarity, compassion. They help the person. And in the process, they find friendship, humor, even love. Something happens and the invincible summer emerges for them. Now, for me, it was interesting because I was thinking of this and I already had the sentence, or it was the time when I stumbled upon that sentence again because I had heard it before. And there was a huge blizzard in New York. And my story happened last year in January in Brooklyn. So it was perfect because the blizzard was like the great metaphor for these people and for the 3 days that they spent together.
And you still start all of your books on the same day, January 8th, right?
Yeah, that's because I'm very disciplined.
Yes, you are.
And also because I tend to procrastinate. If I have a day to begin, then of course I will do it.
So tell us a little bit about these three characters and what they're like. It's so fascinating that they encompass so much history and just the arcs of three lives.
Well, the three characters, very unlikely characters, they all meet in this brownstone in Brooklyn. The owner of the house is a professor at NYU who has had a terrible past. And so he lives a very cautious life in which nothing can happen. He's insured against everything. He lives with his four cats and doesn't want to be bothered with anything, not even friendship or anything. So he has his routines. He's vegan. He's a very methodical man and introverted. And he rents the apartment in the basement of the house to a Chilean journalist and writer, a female, who has come to lecture at NYU. And they, although both are working in the same department in NYU, they hardly talk to each other. He doesn't want his tenants to interfere with his life. And although she's much more open and would like to have a friendship with him, she tries and it doesn't work. And then one night, one of the cats gets sick, And the night of the blizzard, he has to get out. He rear-ends another car, and the car is driven by a young Guatemalan immigrant, a young woman. And then the story begins. And these three characters have had very different lives. Lucia, the woman in the basement, lived through the military coup in Chile when she was very young. Her brother disappeared, was arrested by the military and never appeared, they never knew what happened to him, like thousands of other people. That happened to many people in Chile, and not only in Chile, in other countries in South America also. And so she goes into exile. She lives many years abroad, then goes back to Chile and writes about the dictatorship and about the repression and what happened. And so that's why she's invited to NYU to lecture. She's in her 60s, early 60s, and she's still dynamite. She's spicy and she wants life. Very different from the male character, Richard, who is also in his 60s, but he could be 18 for that matter. And then the young Guatemalan girl is escaping from rape, assassination. All her family has been killed in Guatemala by the narcos and the gangs, which is what's happening today in Guatemala, and that's why people run away. And then Richard has had something that happened in his past in which he blames himself, and he is to be blamed. So the three of them are haunted by the past.
Well, one of the things you do so well in the character of Evelyn Ortega is give us a sense of the fragile life of so many immigrants to America.
Well, I have a foundation.
Right.
That works trying to empower women and girls, mostly, but women and children, say. And one of the themes that my foundation has tackled for years now is immigration and now refugees. Especially after 68,000 minors entered the country in 1 year looking for their parents and with the risk of being deported. So when I wrote the book, Trump was not even a candidate. No one was talking about immigrants as a plague or building a wall to stop them. But the plight of immigrants, especially minors, was in the air already. People were talking, and my foundation was working with them. So cases like Evelyn Ortega, I have several, and I didn't have to invent anything. Just research a little bit about the trip across Mexico, which can happen in many, many ways, depending on how much money you have to pay the coyote.
Mm-hmm. And just, you know, slightly off center stage, there's the specter of those who perpetuate this evil of human trafficking.
Yes, because these people are so vulnerable. Also, most of the time, uneducated. They hear rumors of how things are, but they don't really know. And so often these smugglers end up abusing them terribly. The girls get raped, some get killed. And then when they are almost reaching the United States, then they ask for more money. And these immigrants don't have any money. So then they become indebted to the smugglers, and for years they have to work to pay them.
To get back to this, as these three people are trapped together in this winter storm, they begin to tell their stories. And one of the things this book proves more than anything else is the power of the story itself to affect change. Because so much history is encompassed in these three lives, and they have to reckon with it as they frame their story for each other.
Yes, I think that we really connect at a heart level with other human beings when we hear the stories. When we see the numbers, when we see that hundreds of thousands of people are in Bangladesh starving and escaping from horrors. Those are numbers. Until we hear the story of one woman whose baby was taken from her arms and thrown into the fire, then we see the picture of the woman is one person and one baby, and we can relate. So when we hear the personal story, we realize that all human beings suffer the same way. We all love the same way. We all want the same things. That's not different. If our baby is killed, it's the same here as it is in Bangladesh. And we can relate to the personal story. And that's what happened that night when the three of them, trapped in the blizzard, start talking. And then they begin to connect.
Well, one of the things they do is take on enormous responsibility for one another. And that's something you do as well in your own life with your foundation.
When you really hear another person's story, and you become involved, responsibility comes automatically. You can't avoid it. It's what happens. And that is why it's so important to listen to the others. We live in a country that is completely polarized, in which one side doesn't want to hear what the other side has to say. And there is this divide that is growing and growing. Why don't we sit down and tell each other stories? Tell each other what we want, why we voted for this or for that. Why are we feeling the way we do? We have to listen to the stories, and then we become involved, and then we become responsible.
Well, you're a great advocate for that, as you are for many things. And I know that your recent TED Talks, you focused a lot on passion and keeping the creative life alive as you get older. So I wonder if you talk just a little bit about that, because you do live a very passionate life.
Well, I'm lucky because I have a lot of energy and I'm healthy. And you can talk about passion and about aging involved in the world if you are healthy. If you are sick, then it's over. So I'm very lucky. I'm 75 years old. The TED Talk was, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. When I started writing this book, I was also going through a winter in my own life, a long winter, because my marriage was falling apart. Eventually, I divorced my husband at a very old age when people don't divorce.
Oh.
And so I was living alone, and my life had dramatically changed, and not exactly for the better. And then I started writing the book to exercise my own winter and try to find my own summer. But life is so weird that when I was by the middle of the book, a lawyer in Manhattan who was driving to Boston to see his son heard me on NPR. He contacted my office and he started writing to me every single day to say good morning in the morning and good evening at night. And finally in October, after 5 months, we got to meet. And to make a long story short, he's moving to San Francisco by the end of the year. So he sold his house, got rid of everything he had, and decided to change his life. And this is a guy like Richard in the book.
Uh-huh.
A perfectly organized, methodical life in which nothing could happen, good or bad. And then when he heard this person on NPR, he takes a huge risk and decides that he can open his heart to something. And then his life changes.
And what a daring thing to do, to seduce a writer by writing.
He's 74. Can you imagine?
Yes.
For once, my writing was like prophetic, because I think I sort of invoked the spirit of this lover before I knew he existed.
Ah. So I wish you so much happiness. Oh, that is such a great story. Now, I have to say, I have the question for you. You have always loved New Orleans, and you have written about it.
Oh,
you know, it's the last time you were here was for Island Beneath the Sea. And I noticed that when Richard does have a fantasy of ending it all, it does take place in New Orleans.
Yeah. Because in a way, that has been my fantasy, too. It's such a magical place, especially certain places of New Orleans, that I feel that if I had to find my own death, look for my own death, it would be sitting in one of those bars with a jazz and a drink and wonderful, and the musicians in the street. That's what I want.
Well, all right, but don't look for it anytime soon. We've been speaking with the great Isabel Allende, whose new novel is In the Midst of Winter. You can meet her when she appears in conversation with Anne Gislason, Friday, November 17th at 7 at the Academy of the Sacred Heart NIMS Fine Arts Center. Tickets are available at Garden District Bookshop. Isabel, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you so much for having me. And say hello to all your audience.
And safe travels to you. We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oh, I hope I die in New Orleans. You know what I'm saying, baby. Ever seen the brass and winds play that gospel hymn, the one where Jesus is our friend? They cut you loose.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Mark Halperin to The Reading Life. Mark is the author of such well-known and best-selling books as A Winter's Tale, A Soldier of the Great War, Memoir from Antproof Case, and many other books, including wonderful books for children. His work has appeared in The Atlantic Monthly, The New Criterion, The Wall Street Journal, Commentary, The New York Times, The National Review, and many other publications. He's speaking to us today from his home in Virginia about his splendid new novel, Paris in the Present Tense. Mark Halperin, what an honor it is to speak with you.
It's an honor to speak with you, and you have the most beautiful voice.
Oh, thank you. Now, ever since A Winter's Tale, which is such a lovely book about New York, I thought of you as a kind of poet of the city. And in Paris in the Present Tense, you bring all those gifts to another world capital.
Yes, the difference between the way I've done it in this book and the way it's often done is that we don't have the American man, woman, the man slash woman, meeting the charming French man slash woman, drinking a lot of wine, going to savoring the local cuisine, falling in love again. This, of course, after the divorce, and this person has come to Paris. That's a genre of book that I really have never read. I've seen a couple of movies based on them, but this is different. It's more realistic and gritty. Not gritty in the bad sense, but I mean the details are different. When I go to a city abroad, I don't usually go to the place where the tourists go. I go to the suburbs. I go to the schools, the sports facilities, the factories, the office buildings, places where the people who live there actually live, where their culture is made. Because culture is not something that you can buy a ticket to. Those are the products of culture. You know, the painting, music, all the wonderful things that we have are the products of the culture. They are the art that culture creates. And the culture is found actually in the city itself, in the places where tourists generally don't go because it's not found in the museums or the concert halls or whatever. That's the product of it.
Now, as you say, this book takes place in a Paris suburb largely, but there's the beauty is still there. The possibility of love and romance is still there. And working artists are still there. But prejudice and violence are there as well.
Yeah. I think that these days there's been a sort of a compression of what a novel should be like. And you get very short magazine-like article novels. And they're limited and narrowed. So you get things that are titled something like the girl with the broken weed whacker, the Egyptian osteopath baboon, and they're deliberately unambitious. Unlike the 19th century novel and even the early 20th century novel, in which the book is supposed to be about a lot of things moving across and along and across many many levels. So that the product of all these things is greater than the sum of the individual.
Now, I always think of you as such a generous writer. You're generous with an abundance of beautiful, elaborate, and evocative language. And part of that, I think, is that you take on such great subjects, such large subjects. And one of those, of course, is time, as the title of your new book suggests.
It's funny because I originally thought to title the book Paris in the Present Tense, and I thought I would write it in the present tense because I'd never written anything in the present tense, and it is a compelling form. But it turns out that it was too modern for me. I mean, I'm not keyed to that, and I decided that I find myself writing it in my normal way in the all tenses. In fact, there's one chapter that's written in the present tense just because it somehow fits. Called Jacqueline at Sparta, and it's just right for the present tense. But then when I found that I wasn't writing it in the present tense, I decided to title it The Music of Paris, because it's a great deal about music.
Yes.
It's a book about musicians, their lives, and the music itself and its ineffable quality, and as much as you can convey that in prose. And then I decided that, no, I would revert to my original title, even though the whole thing wasn't in the present tense, because it is about Paris in the present,
mm-hmm.
And Paris fact is that it's about Paris as it is now. And as it is now, strangely enough, it's really just as exciting and beautiful and difficult and even mortally dangerous as it has always been throughout its history. And one of the charms of Paris is that it can carry through the present into the past. There's a kind of a chain. In Arabic, it's called an isnad, which means a chain of learning. We also have Kurt Gödel's book, The Golden Braid. Things are braided, and you find that the past is as contemporary in Paris as is the present. So, by being there, even just by being there, you have the richness of the past somehow combined with the currency of the present.
And in New Orleans, too. I think you'll see that when you're here. That will be interesting to see.
Yeah.
Now, this is a book that draws on many of your strengths, your love of music, your understanding of the lives of soldiers and that experience of wartime, your love of city lore, and your sense of the interior lives of men. Do you think this was a book that you had to be ready to write? That was, you know?
Yeah, you hit it right on the head, because I had lived in France when I was a small child, and then this was in the right after the war, and then when in fact things seemed very much like they were in the war, because war production had not shifted all over the world very very quickly into civilian production, so the styles and the buildings and the products were very much like they were at the beginning of the war and during the war. And also in France, when I lived there, there were many ruined buildings, bombed out buildings, and bullet holes in walls and things. So I lived there at that time. And then when I was between 8 and 12, I lived with people whose names were Louis and Marie Mignon. They're in the book, actually, the wonderful people who Louis had fought the First World War and been wounded at Verdun, his Legion of Honor. And in the Second World War, they were in the resistance. And they harbored Jews in their attic and were almost discovered. Luckily, they were not. The whole story in itself. But in 1968, when there was all the trouble in France with the revolutionary students, I had a vision of it, of Paris as a kind of a golden fire, like the pillar of fire in the Bible, rising above Paris from the chaos and the violence that was going on. And it was, and I actually felt this and saw it and heard in my mind the piece Les Barricades Mystérieuses by Couperin, and it was a vision. But I wanted to write it then, but I realized as I tried, and I did, I got about 80 pages. I was way too young, and it was only half a century later that I was able to bring my experience and the fruits of having lived for another half century to bear upon that vision and fill it out in this book.
Well, I'm grateful you waited for that half century. I love this book so much. Now, this is very much a book about what comes with age, the sense of clearing things out and getting to what's essential. And there's a little passage on page 305 that I wish you would read because I love it so much.
Tell me when to begin.
Ready.
I'm not embarrassed or disturbed that I've lost so much, any more than a farmer would be embarrassed or disturbed that the wind has blown the chaff from the threshing floor and left only the wheat. You may not understand this until you're much older, but to people of my age, it's a given, if one will take it, that things become at once more beautiful, more intense, and more inexplicable. You learn to see with your emotions and feel with your reason. If, at its end, the life you're living takes on the attributes of art, it doesn't matter if you forgot where you put your reading glasses.
I have to say, I find that very comforting.
Well, you sound very young.
No, no. No. We've been talking with novelist Mark Halperin about his wonderful new book, Paris in the Present Tense. You can meet him on his first visit to New Orleans, Friday, November 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Mark, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Lynn Farwell White discusses Insign's Gifts in Giving, The Art of Thoughtful Giving, Tuesday, November 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Legendary journalist Bob Schieffer, former host of Face the Nation, and co-author Andrew Schwartz of the Center for Strategic and International Studies discuss Insign Overload, Finding the Truth in Today's Deluge of News, Wednesday, November 8th at 6 at Rogers Memorial Chapel at Tulane University. Jamie Attenberg reads from her novel All Grown Up, Thursday, November 9th at 6 at the New Orleans Public Library Main Library. Joel Dinnerstein discusses his book, The Origins of Cool in Postwar America, with Maurice Ruffin, Thursday, November 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. STARE, Start the Adventure in Reading, holds its annual fundraiser, The STARE Affair, November 9th. The theme this year is The Tale of Peter Rabbit. For tickets, visit starenola.org. MacArthur winner Jesmyn Ward signs her most recent novel, Sing, Unburied Sing, Saturday, November 11th at noon at Barnes & Noble Metairie. Claudia Gray signs her new young adult novel, Defy the Stars, Saturday, November 11th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. The big event this week is the New Orleans Book Festival, which takes place Saturday, November 11th from 1 to 7 at Big Lake in City Park. A wonderful day of books in the park and music by the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra at 5:30. There will be fireworks at 7 to kick off the city's tricentennial celebrations. Among the authors on hand will be Elise Arden, Jason Barry, Anne Benoit, Jean Castles, John Couray, Claudia Gray, Greg Heron, Peggy Scott Laborde, Bill Lofelm, Denise McConduit, Grace Millsaps and Ryan Murphy, Jean Redman, Erica Spindler and Kavanjane Wallace and Jesmyn Ward. Every child who attends will receive a free book. Check out nolabookfest.org for information. Room 220 presents poet and novelist Eileen Miles, reading from Afterglow, a memoir, Thursday, November 16th at 7 at the Saturn Bar. Today's guest, Mark Helprin, discusses Insign's Paris in the Present Tense, Friday, November 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Isabella Allende, discusses her book In the Midst of Winter with Anne Gislason, Friday, November 17th at 7 at the Academy of the Sacred Heart NIMS Fine Arts Center. This is a ticketed event. Go to GardenDistrictBookshop.com for more information. The National World War II Museum presents the 10th Annual International Conference on World War II. That's November 16th through 18th at the museum, with three full days of internationally known writers discussing their work. For more information, go to www2conference.com. And Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans presented by the Pirate Sally Faulkner Society, is set for December 6th through 11th with featured guests Walter Isaacson, John Gregory Brown and Carrie Brown, Andrew Burstein and Nancy Eisenberg, Jeff Kleinman, and Deborah Grosvenor. For information and to register, check out wordsandmusic.org. And if it's November, it's National Novel Writing Month, which sets writers on the path of writing a 50,000-word novel by November 30th. The Lakeshore Branch Library, 1000 West Esplanade, hosts writing sessions from 5 to 8:30 every Monday in November. Shannon Kitchens facilitates. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.